in Acts chapter 1, they're discussing this whole situation with Judas. And it says, in Acts chapter 1, verse 18, "Now this man acquired a field with the price of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his intestines gushed out. And it became known to all who were living in Jerusalem, so that in their own language, that field was called," how would you say that? Hakeldama? Yeah, it's Aramaic. It's Hakaldama. Yeah, Hakaldama. That is the field of blood. Okay, so we read that last week, but we didn't read this part. Acts 1 verse 20 here. "For it is written in the book of Psalms, let his homestead be made desolate, and let no one dwell in it. And let another man take his office. Therefore, it is necessary that the men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out and among us, beginning with the baptism of John, until the day he was taken up from us, one of these must be a witness with us to his resurrection." This is great, because what you have is the apostles sitting around after the death of Judas discussing whether or not to put a 12th in to replace him. And so they go to the scriptures, and they're reading from the Psalms, and they read in the Psalms where it says, "Let his homestead be made desolate, let no one dwell in it," where David is cursing Joab. "Let his homestead be made desolate, let no one dwell in it." And they say, "That's about Judas, because this is all about us." It's all about us. That's about Judas. Therefore, we don't replace it. We are now the 11. We're no longer the 12. But someone else comes along and says, "But it's also written in the Psalms, let another man take his office. So therefore we must replace him and put someone else in the 12th spot." And so, isn't this great? Because Acts presents both the major proof texts that were being used to argue back and forth. Now, in a strictly literal interpretation, neither of them are about Judas at all. But that didn't matter to the apostles.
It's all about them.
Right, to the apostles, this is relevant. It's absolutely relevant. Okay? Because this is just like Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, you know, "Lebanon, let a fire come in and devour your cedars."
So how did they weigh those disparate verses?
Well, apparently, to get to the conclusion they did, they must have had a long argument, which is skipped over in the book of Acts. But I'm sure there was a church split. Yes.
Yeah. They had to replace somebody that left for somebody else.
Right. They ended up replacing 6 disciples. That's why you never hear about those guys again after this. All right. So, all of this is just to make this suggestion to you that we need to understand how the apostles read the scriptures, how they understood the scriptures. And I'm coming back to that third possibility for the missed citation, that is a source compendium, that perhaps Matthew had another source compendium that he was drawing on and he misquoted it. I know that's no better, but it's more interesting. And it's Matthew's style. When you do compare the synoptics and you look, say that you take a gospel, a parallel gospel account that lays them out next to each other, and you look at Luke's version of it and Mark's version of it and Matthew's version of it, Matthew's is always truncated. Matthew always squishes stuff down. He gets writer's cramp or something, you know, and it's always a little shorter. And sometimes, I've pointed out in his parables before, he'll skip the whole parable and just give you the meaning of the parable, you know, and then you're left recreating the parable. You know, we don't always notice that, but he does that. So that's his style. Matthew truncates. I started to imagine, after class last week, what if there was such a compendium? What if it was a compendium of Midrash? And what if Matthew truncated it? You know? Could that be? What if both these texts are relevant and were in the original compendium, like an apostolic compendium of Midrash about the Master, and Matthew had it, but it was a really long passage, and so he truncated it? Because it would be inappropriate anyway to go off into a long Midrashic discourse in the middle of your gospel narrative, right at the critical dramatic moment before the crucifixion. Mm-hmm. So what if that was the case? So I started to think, if that was the case, we should be able to find some clues about this, okay? Because Midrash is not random. Now, if you were to pull a book of Midrash off the shelf and start reading, you'd say this is random. But as you get to know it more and more, you realize, no, it's not random. It's based on some really specific things, but they just seem bizarre to us. So one of the, there's a lot of like verbal, linguistic things like puns. There's a lot of puns. Like the word sounds like this. Because the sages didn't really speak Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic. But they knew Hebrew very, very well. But it was a second language to them. So you know, when you're learning a language, you make associations in the language that. Anyway, so that's what they would always do. That's one thing, is verbal puns in the scripture is often a basis of Midrash. Any sort of discrepancy, a textual discrepancy, is a basis of Midrash. So like, for example, if it was talking in the plural and then it switched to the singular, oh, we need a Midrash to explain what happened here. Anything like that. A spelling error is a basis for Midrash. And then there's also this, and this comes from Hillel. Hillel invented a rule of exegesis called Gezerah Shavah. I think it's Hillel. I sure hope it's Hillel. It could be Ishmael. Doesn't matter. But Akiva refined it. But anyway, Gezerah Shavah means equal measures or equal edicts or something like that. I don't know what it means. I know how it works. It works like this. Say you're reading a text and you're reading a Hebrew text. And remember, Hebrew is second language for you. You're reading a Hebrew text and you say, what's that word mean? You go and find the word in another passage where you can identify what it means from the context, and then you bring that meaning of the word back to your original passage, and that's what it means. Regardless of if that's what it means or not, that's now what it means. that's the original idea of Gezerah Shavah. But as the sages began to use this more and more, they used it more and more loosely. And they used it to the point where any time you had a string of a phrase in one text that you could find in another text, you linked the two texts. That made a relationship between the two texts. Or a peculiar word in one that was spelled in a peculiar way and it was spelled in a peculiar... It was a way of connecting two different passages. And so we see the apostles use this technique a lot. The most famous example is... The Master's, what are the two greatest commandments? Ve'ahavta, ve'ahavta. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The only two mitzvahs in the Torah that both start with the same word, ve'ahavta, and you shall love. So he makes a Gezerah Shavah and puts one commandment that's from a various and sundry collection in Leviticus 19 with the big commandment from the Shema, he puts them together. What's the point of putting them together? Well, there's a ranking, greatest commandment, second greatest commandment. He says everything else hangs on these. But as a Gezerah Shavah, there's also a literal linking that happens. So now, in the teaching of the Master, what does it mean you shall love God? Well, it means love your neighbor as yourself. That's how you love God. And what does it mean to love your neighbor? Well, that's your love for God. You know, so, and we see John in his epistles makes that clear. He carries that out, right? He shows you that. How can you say you love God if you don't love your neighbor? So that's a Gezerah Shavah. That's a one that's easy to get your mind around, but Ahavta, right? So I thought, what if we could find a Gezerah Shavah between these two passages? And I did. And I was really, really enthusiastic about that. So, in Jeremiah 32:8, remember Jeremiah said, after his cousin came and he said, redeem the field, Jeremiah said, then I knew that this was the word of the Lord. Remember that? And in Zechariah, after the shepherd breaks the staves, it says, they will know that this was the word of the Lord. It's the only two places in the Bible that the exact phrase appears. Yeah.
Done,
yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. Right. So it's the only place that the exact phrase appears. One of them is first person, you know, and the other one is third person, plural. But nevertheless, the ki davar Adonai hu is identical. It absolutely identical, and it's the only two places that I can find that it appears.
That's the spot for the reference of, from the I Will Break the Staves.
Zechariah 11:11. Mm-hmm. So, now I think, knowing that, it becomes very easy, if you know Midrash, to kind of reconstruct it and to put it back together. So, yes.
You know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger's second Terminator, or like we're going to Under the Sea World, Florida.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
Basically, it is.
Good.
Yep. So here's I have this on your sheet where it says an apostolic midrash reconstructed, and what I'm suggesting is that things went down something like this: Judas threw the money back. The priests collect it. They say, we can't put it into the treasury. It's blood money. Then they say, well, what should we do with it? Well, there's this piece of property outside of Jerusalem called Potter's Field that we could use the money to buy because we need a place to bury all these Romans anyway. I don't know if it's Romans, but all these non-Jews in Jerusalem, they keep dying. And then what do you do with them? Because you can't put them in a Jewish cemetery. So they buy this place called Potter's Field. And but because it was bought with blood money, it's called Chakal Dama, at least among the apostles. Or alternatively, according to Acts, because out in that field is where Judas died and split open, it's called Chakal Dama. Or perhaps both.
Just like the potter and treasury, I mean, both really
right.
Are relevant. For
both are relevant,
about.
Yep. So, Matthew says, then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to us? See to that yourself. Now listen for that. See to that yourself. You're going to see that in this passage. So here's my reconstructed Midrash. And before I read it, let me show you how it works. The ellipsis... the ellipsis marks are omissions of text that you could easily make if you're creating a midrash, just because you just want the good parts and not the parts that wreck it for you. And that's what the ellipsis marks are. The text in italics is the Gezerah Shavah between the two passages that allow you to toggle from one to the other, and the capital letters are the parts that Matthew would have quoted, hypothetically speaking, if we're really, we're kind of playing a game here, but like hypothetically speaking, this is how it could have been reconstructed. Okay, so it is written in the prophet Jeremiah, you have the right of possession, and the redemption is yours. Buy it for yourself. But who is this who owns the right to possess and the right to redeem? The Messiah, son of David. Now, and a side point here. Son of David is, in Hebrew, Ben David, right? Mm-hmm. The word cousin is also Ben David. Your cousin, it's Hanamel, is Jeremiah is Hanamel's cousin. But it's actually pronounced Ben Dod, because Dod means uncle, so son of your uncle, Ben Dod, is the same as Ben David. Except ordinarily the Vav then drops out, but nevertheless it's understood. Okay? So who is this who owns the right to possess and the right to redeem? The Messiah, son of David. And with what does he purchase? He buys it for himself with the 30 shekels of Judas. For Jeremiah says, and now we begin the Midrash proper, then I knew that this was the word of the Lord. I bought the field, and I weighed out the silver. And it also says in Zechariah, those who were watching me knew that this was the word of the Lord. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I threw the shekels of silver. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Thus they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me, saying, buy it for yourself. All right. So that is, of course, completely hypothetical, reconstructed Midrash. But the capital letters allow you to see how Matthew could have taken just the bits he wanted for his narrative and given you Matthew 27:9-10, which is printed below here, and still retained then, in good conscience, the Jeremiah association with the Zechariah text. All right? So, what does the Midrash mean? Can we parse out a little bit of this Midrash? Jeremiah is the one who's being told, redeem it, you have the right of redemption. To the apostles, the way that they read the prophets, they hear someone being told, you have the right of redemption and the right of possession. That can only be the Messiah. He's, you know, because, why? Because all the prophets bear witness of him, right? And the spirit of Messiah was in them testifying. So to the apostles, they would be reading that, they'd say, that's about, you know, that must be Messiah. And so what does he redeem it with? He redeems it with this purchase price, the 30 shekels. Now what is the 30 shekels? The 30 shekels we know from Exodus 21:32 is the value the Torah assigns to the life of a slave. 30 shekels. So the 30 shekels represents his life. That's his life. So with what does he redeem and with what does he purchase this right of redemption? With his life. And what is his life? It's the 30 shekels. And so with the 30 shekels, they bought the potter's field. As it says, buy it for yourself, or buy it with yourself. Buy it with your life. So this is what the apostles would be seeing and excited about and wanting to loop you back to and tie these things together. So when the priests say to Judas, see to it yourself, it's like a little hint of where we are in the text, of what we're looking at in the prophets. So this is the kind of, I mean, there you go. I mean, what could you do? Could you like show this to Asher Norm and he's like, oh, I see your point. Now I guess I do believe in Jesus. Yeah. No, probably not. This is a hypothetical reconstruction. It's just kind of fun. It's the kind of stuff that I like to do, that I like to play with. But it does, so is it really valuable? Not not this particular piece, perhaps, but the idea, the concept, and to understand that this is how our New Testament writers thought, and not just them, but greater Judaism all around them in their day. And so if we're going to scrutinize the Gospels or the writings of the epistles or the Revelation, we need to do it through this kind of lens rather than just pulling them apart. So I think, what's the lesson? Give Matthew the benefit of the doubt.